tu. Test, test. Okay. Good morning or good day, everybody. As the head of NISLAB, it's a pleasure to welcome you all to NIS Lecture 2013 number 3. And it's nice to see, even if we got a big auditorium today, we kind of have a feeling that it's a bit crowded. So that means there's quite a lot of people coming in for the lecture today. Right away, I'd like to say that, again, we are streaming out what's happening here and have an audio feed as well out on the internet. And this will be recorded and posted on the NIS Lecture website, just so that you're aware of it and comfortable with that. For the questions afterwards, we'll pass around the mic so that everybody gets the question. And even if Tarjei has prepared about 3/4 of an hour, we'll fit in some questions and discussions at the end. Today we have one of our alumni who has accepted the invitation to come and give a talk on the challenges that he is working on currently. Tarjei Mandt got his Master in Information Security from HIG back in 2005, and today he is working in Azimut Security as a Senior Security Researcher. He has previously spoken at similar events as NIS Lecture, well, that means Black Hat, USA, Recon, Hack in the Box, and SysSec. Today he will tell us about some of his experience with the iOS kernel. I give the word to you, Tarjei. Thank you and welcome. Mute.
Hello. Oh. So yeah. I guess I'll do this in English. My name is Tarjei Mandt. I work for Azimut Security. This is a small security consultant company originally based in Sydney. We're 5 people, so it's really small. Previously, I worked for Norman, and then I also worked, I also worked for the Norwegian Defense. So my recent focus has been on Apple iOS and OS X. I've also done research on Windows. The most recent one was on the Windows 8 heap with Chris Valsek. There's the link to my blog. It has some Windows stuff as well. I'm also in the program committee of a few conferences, so if you are interested in academic or security conferences, you should check these out. And I got my master's in information security from this place. It's good to be back. So iOS 6, Apple released this operating system in September 2012. It has a large focus on security improvements, specifically aimed towards the iOS kernel, such as randomized address-based layouts. It primarily targets strategies employed in jailbreaks. So there's been a number of previous jailbreaks on iOS, on iOS 4, iOS 5, and these hardenings aim to mitigate those. There's also been additional security improvements in iOS 6.1, but these are not really related to the kernel mitigations, so we won't go into those, but one of those is the service hardening. So who here has heard about Evasion? Huh, nice. So Evasion was the first public jailbreak for iOS 6. In fact, it's the only one right now. It was released in February 2013, and it basically allows users to run any application, any code they want on the device without any sandbox restrictions, without any lockdown enforcements. And you're also able to run unsigned code. So Evasion itself is pretty huge. It comprises several components. It has the injection vector, so you need a way to get code onto the device. There's a persistence component that needs to, so when you reboot your device, the jailbreak needs to start over again. And there's also a kernel exploit that is used for gaining full control of the operating system. And that is what this talk is going to be about. So today we're going to, this talk is going to be about split into two parts. In the first part, we'll look at iOS 6 and specifically what sort of stuff Apple did to make exploit writers' lives hard or to mitigate, to address malware and stuff like that. In the second part, we'll go into the gory details and look at the kernel exploit itself. We'll look at the vulnerability. We'll look at how they overcome all these mitigations and eventually achieve a way of executing arbitrary code, which is the end goal. So if you really enjoy this, there's a bunch of things or papers and books you might want to check out. The first one is a talk that I and Mark Dow did last year. Then there's a lot of other good iOS presentations. There's one on the Apple Sandbox, one on iOS code signing, and there's also a lot of books you can check out. iOS Hacker's Handbook, A Guide to Kernel Exploitation, which is specifically on kernel exploitation. And if you're into OS X and iOS in general, there's a few good internals books you can look at as well. So on to the first part, where we look at the kernel security itself in iOS. So one of the big things they did was to introduce something known as kernel address space layout randomization. This is really to randomize the layout of the kernel binaries and the kernel allocations. And it's to prevent attackers from using known addresses. So in iOS 5, you could typically reference an address or point to an address that was known. You would always know that the kernel was loaded at a specific address, and you can use that. So this mitigation is to prevent that. And it's divided into two parts. You have the randomization of the kernel image itself, and also the randomization of something that's called the kernel map, and that's the representation of the layout of the kernel memory, virtual memory. The kernel base is randomized by the bootloader when you boot the device. So it pulls some random data from timing information and generates a SHA-1 hash of this, and then takes a byte from the SHA-1 hash to calculate the kernel slide. So it uses this byte in this specific formula right here to get a offset that it uses to slide the kernel. So the address at which the kernel is put is here the adjusted base. So normally in iOS 5 you would have 8000000 where the kernel was always loaded. In iOS 6 you now have the slide as well. So this means that you used the slide byte. This means that the kernel can be rebased at 256 possible locations. And the base addresses are 2 megabytes apart, and this is due to some cache optimization. It's not a really good ASLR, but it's sufficient enough to prevent you from attacking using known addresses. The other mitigation was on the kernel map. This is used for kernel allocations of all types. So you have like calloc. Kernel memory allocates. It spans across all the kernel space, and you also have submap of the kernel map, so you can define a memory zone sort of within this huge map, such as the zone map, the IPC kernel map, etc. And the goal in this mitigation is to make allocations less predictable. So when you allocate something early on, when you boot, you don't want it to end up in the same location the next time you boot, because then you can know where this allocation will be placed and attack that somehow. So the idea here is to try to randomize the base of the kernel map, And it does this by generating a 9-bit value and using that as a vector or a seed for initial allocation. So this is multiplied by page size, so you have 512 different allocation size possibilities in this case. So this means that once you made this initial allocation, subsequent allocations in this kernel map will be pushed forward by this random amount. iOS actually removes this allocation later on the first garbage collect. So you don't actually lose memory. You'll be able to reuse it, but you won't be able to know where these allocations early on are made. So this is a diagram of the kernel map layout. So the cray map offset is this initial allocation that is made that is random. It's between 0 and 2 megabytes. The kernel image is put at a random location, as said earlier. And then all these other zone maps, calloc maps, etc., are shifted depending on the K-map offset. One thing to notice here is that despite this randomization, there are a few fixed regions. At the bottom, you have the vector table, which is ARM-specific. So it's always loaded at this address. You also have the comp page, which is shared between user mode and kernel mode. So there's still some things that aren't entirely randomized. And evasion actually uses this information to its advantage when triggering the kernel exploit. But we'll talk more about that later. The second mitigation is kernel address-based protection. And this is to prevent whenever you have some sort of dereference in kernel space, you don't want that to touch user space. So now both user memory and kernel memory is entirely separated. Previously, for instance, on iOS 5, kernel and user shared address space. And you had some sort of null dereference mitigation by ensuring that binaries have this page zero section. But this only prevents you from triggering null dereferences. It doesn't prevent you from touching other places in the user space. So in iOS 6, the kernel task has its own address space while executing. And you switch to this address space whenever you do an interrupt or whenever you do a copy in or a copy out. So whenever the kernel executes, the idea here is that it never touches user mode pages because user mode pages are not trusted. If you have any sort of vulnerability in the kernel and that vulnerability ends up referencing user mode pages, you can possibly affect execution. And that's what this mitigation tries to prevent. So this is, again, the layout of the user mode task and the kernel task. So whenever the kernel executes, the user task map is unmapped, so it won't be able to touch that memory. The reason why the kernel map is mapped in the user mode task is because of cache optimization again. There's no reason to swap that out because you can't touch those pages anyway because they're marked as those are kernel pages basically, so they'll trigger a fault if you access them. You can also here see the vector tables and the comp page, both at the same address. So if you're familiar with ARM, ARM version 6 has two translation table based registers, and this translates like virtual to physical memory. So what's unique here is that since you have two, you have one for the process-specific addresses and one for the OS kernel. On Windows, like on x86, you only have one, so you can't have this sort of separation. In x86, they have different mitigations for dealing with user mode dereferences. So Ivy Bridge processors had something called SMEP, and that means it's supervisor mode execution prevention. So if you try to execute user mode instruction from the kernel, you'll trigger a fault. And in Haswell, which Intel will release this July or something, they will also have SMAP, which is access protection, and that also applies to writes and reads, not just execution. Anyway, so in this case, whenever the kernel is executed, the OS translation table-based register is just mirrored into the one where the process is supposed to be. So it's the same. Another thing is that's important to mention is that memory is no longer read-write executable. So in iOS 5, again, you could just simply write to executable memory and execute it. Now it's usually just read executable. So if you try to write to that memory, you'll trigger an access violation. So this means that kernel code cannot be directly patched. The heap is non-executable, the stack is non-executable, and the syscall table, the one that defines all the entry points whenever you do a system call, is no longer writable. So this is moved into a read-only data section. So another mitigation is to prevent information leaks. So when you randomize the kernel and its allocations in order to prevent you from using that information, you also need to prevent the attacker from knowing where allocations are made from and learning information about the address space. And there's various things iOS does in this case. One is to disable some APIs. Historically, there were a lot of APIs that would pass pointers that would be objects in the kernel. So in some cases, it just disables those. The most prevalent one is the obfuscation of kernel pointers. So instead of taking the APIs out, they simply just add some random value to the pointer. And the last one is just to zero out the pointers instead of returning them back to user. So when I said this disable APIs, this is one example. You have an API called host zone info or max zone info, and this allows you to query information about the state of the kernel allocator. It allows you to determine how many free allocations are left in a particular zone. So this is very useful to an attacker because an attacker can use this to know whenever a heap is filled. And when a heap is filled, you will allocate new pages, so you get fresh memory, and it's very predictable. So this API was quite useful. Now in iOS 6, it requires you to have debug access enabled, and this is enabled as a boot argument, so you can't just do that on your iPhone. There's a lot of other APIs that disclose kernel object pointers as well. These are just like some of them. Mac port K object returns the object of certain port objects, and Mac port space info returns also port objects. So it's a lot of useful information an attacker can leverage. And these APIs are used for a lot of reasons. Sometimes the underlying APIs are more important. And some pointers which these APIs provide are also used as unique identifiers or handles. So you have like a pipe inode number is actually an object to the corresponding pipe object, a pointer to the corresponding pipe object. So clearly that discloses some information about where this pipe object is in memory. So the strategy here is to obfuscate these pointers. And to do that, it generates a random value at boot time and adds that random value to the real pointer. So this is from the XNU source code, which is used in iOS. So you see that in the first box, it does early random or one, it puts that into VM kernel add rperm. And it uses that random value to randomize the C pipe in the bottom box to obfuscate that pointer. So it tries to prevent you from learning information about the address space So you don't really know where this pipe object is right now. Other APIs, they disclose pointers unnecessarily. So the strategy in this case is just to zero them out. And that is used to mitigate some leaks via syscontrol or other APIs. This is another class of mitigations, but I won't talk too much about this because it's not really relevant for the evasion kernel exploit, but it's worth mentioning that the kernel stack has cookies added. Cookies are meant to prevent you from overwriting return addresses on the stack. So before it jumps to the return address, it checks the cookie. So if you have an overflow and try to corrupt the kernel, corrupt the return address, you'll also corrupt the cookie, so the system will shut down or panic and prevent you from gaining code execution. There's also multiple hardenings to the kernel heap. There's additional pointer validation for pointers passed to the free functions. There's block poisoning, which means you taint whenever you free an allocation. You taint memory, so you fill the memory with garbage in order to prevent you from learning information that might have been in that memory before. And there's also free list integrity verification, which is whenever you free some memory, you put it on a list. And that list is a singly linked list, so you have a next pointer to the next pointer to the next pointer, etc. And this mitigation is put there to prevent you from misusing or replacing that pointer with something else. So it encodes the pointer, puts that in somewhere else in memory and in that specific chunk, and whenever it allocates that memory again, it checks the pointer if it's the correct one. It checks the encoding. This is described in more detail in the other talk I mentioned. Okay, so that was like iOS 6 kernel security summarized in 20 minutes. Or 20 minutes. So this is, we're now going to move on to the kernel exploit itself. It's probably the most complex kernel exploit written ever for iOS, at least publicly. It uses a kernel vulnerability to gain full control of the OS kernel, and it's the IOUSB device family driver, so it's the driver that talks over USB or gives your application ability to talk over USB. It's primarily required to evade sandbox restrictions and code signing enforcement. So once you have full control of the OS kernel, you can basically do whatever you want. You can install OpenSSH. You can, you know, nothing prevents you from doing anything anymore. And like I said, it's really complex. It's actually written by this one guy, David Wong, also known as Planet Being. He's really cool. But yeah, so I guess I owe him some thanks for this. IOUSB device family is the kernel extension that enables the iPhone or the iPad to communicate with a host over USB. And this can be like iTunes or accessory port devices. You put your device in a speaker that accepts the iPhone port. It's also used by several applications and daemons. So you have like the picture transfer protocol daemon, which uses this, which is like the standardized protocol for transferring pictures from a camera or a phone. And there's also the media server daemon, which does the USB audio streaming. So this driver really represents the USB support on the device itself, whereas you have also IOUSB family on OS X, which is more the host end. So this is specifically towards an iDevice. So we're going to go into some more details now. If you fall asleep, don't worry. It's probably boring, but so USB device interface is the interface that user space applications talk to when they talk over USB. This interface provides a user client, and a user client is actually what you talk to. And it exposes a lot of methods. So you have like read pipe, write pipe, create some, you know, a lot of different methods that would be needed to support USB interaction. And it's commonly accessed from a user space library. So you have this separate library that does all this that you talk to. So if you've done any OSX development, this is a CF plugin extension, so it's very easy to integrate and use. But you can also talk to this user client directly without the use of this user space library. And that's where things start getting ugly, I don't know. And it's worth noting that this is accessible to task only with a USB entitlement. So all the application on an iPhone device can get entitlements in order to permit them to do certain things. So for instance, if you try to trigger this vulnerability from Mobile Safari, it won't work because Mobile Safari is not allowed to interact over USB. So you can't actually use this exploit remotely. You have to evasion actually only uses this exploit whenever it boots. So it's not a critical vulnerability in the sense that it can be mass deployed to compromise tons of devices. You sort of need physical access, or you need to leverage a vector different from Mobile Safari. So this is the way applications talk to this USB interface. So typically, you would go through this IO USB device library, which has a user class called the same thing, and then that would talk to the user client in the device family driver. So when we talk about USB, a pipe is a communication channel between your host system or a device and the device or the endpoint, the other end basically. And applications, whenever you reference a pipe, you normally use their pipe value or index value. So for instance, index 0 is the default control pipe for doing configuration. And you get the other indexes by calling this getNum endpoints on the interface object. And that gives you like a number, and then you go from index 1 up to the top number and query those, et cetera, et cetera. So you normally operate with indexes when using pipe channels or doing transfers and stuff. And this value, this index value, is normally passed as an argument to the user client, telling the user client, I want to use this pipe. Go ahead and do that. Do this operation for me, please. So on OSX, on IO USB family, which is very similar, we can see that this user client has a routine called reset pipe that takes the index, and then it translate that index into a pipe object. So this is the normal way of doing things. This is the right way of doing things, because you should never trust anything that the user mode or user applications pass to the kernel. You should always validate. So, you know, passing anything else, passing a pointer that the kernel trusts would be silly. So this is the right way. Unfortunately, IO USB device family, the one on the iDevice, does not operate with pipe index values. Instead, it takes pointers to the pipe object pointers passed in directly from user mode. And this is pretty bad because the kernel then trusts you to pass valid pointers, and you can pass anything. And the methods also that takes this pointer only check if the pointer is non-null. This means that the attacker can connect to the user client and specify an arbitrary pipe pointer to have it operate on an arbitrary object or any memory in the kernel it wants. So the attack vector is this. You have an application that connects to IO USB device interface, and you call any API that accepts a pipe object pointer, such as stall pipe, and it starts operating on this pointer. So if you know ARM, it's somewhat similar to x86 assembly. So the, on this first slide, the line in red is basically the check that only checks if the pipe object pointer is null. If it's not null, it happily accepts this pointer value passed in from user mode or from any user application. It then uses this memory and checks a certain offset in that memory if it's 1. And apparently this 1 means that it's active. And if it's 1, it will start using other objects referenced by this memory until at the very bottom it calls a function. So there's a lot of dereferences going on here. A lot of, you know, you can easily get confused in all this, so especially if you're not familiar with ARM. But I tried to make it a bit more clear. So on the left side, on the left box, you have the pipe object that is passed to this function. So this can be any pointer again. It can point to any memory, potentially memory that the attacker has an ability to influence, and that's the end goal, really. So this pipe object has an object X, which I call, I just named these objects random things, but it has an object X that has references to object Y, object Z. And you can see here, I tried to bold out the arguments that gets, so eventually it calls this function with these arguments that I write right here. Like this is the second argument. This is the first argument. So the first argument is a bit tricky because it's not really an argument. It's the object. But you still control this object. And then the third argument. So if you're able to control this memory, if you can control all these values, then you're pretty good. You're doing pretty well. So, like I said, an attacker who can control the memory that you point to can potentially control execution. So you can decide whether the kernel should do this, the kernel should do that. On iOS 5, the attacker could simply, because there's no address space separation, he could allocate some memory in user mode and point the pointer there. So the kernel would point, the kernel would start operating on the user mode buffer, and you would easily win. Like there, it's no stress at all. On iOS 6, you have the address space separation, so you can't do that. So Invasion has to find a way to inject user control data into kernel memory. So the attack strategy is this. You want to inject user control data into kernel memory. And this is needed because you need to control the values in this fake object that you pass. You also need to learn the location of the user control data. So you can't just inject some stuff into memory. You also need to know where it is. And this typically requires an information disclosure. And you also need to learn the base address of the kernel in order to patch the necessary values. So you want to patch certain values in the kernel, et cetera, et cetera. And this requires you to build some primitives. So you need a way to read memory. You need a way to write memory. So it's a bit of an effort, unlike iOS 5, where you could just go for the win immediately. So I guess I'm running a bit out of time, but we'll try to see how long we get with this. So like I said, you need a way to inject memory, and you need a way to disclose some information about where that memory is. One way that the Evasion uses is to request a memory mapping by interacting with this IO USB device interface. And this creates something called an IO memory map kernel objects. And the thing here is that this object, the address of that object is returned back to the user. And this is very typical OS X or iOS returning, you know, pointers as handles or identifiers. And they tried to obfuscate a lot of those, but in this case, they didn't. And the pointer in this case, the object in this case, gets allocated in this calloc 88 zone. So kernel memory is optimized by dividing zones into how big the allocations are. So calloc 88 is for 88 byte allocations. The reason it says 68 here is because it doesn't have a 68 zone, it has an 88 zone, so it goes to the next one. So here we call this API. We get a data pointer, capacity, and a map token. And in this case, map token is the pointer to kernel memory. So okay, that's great. Now evasion can allocate an object in kernel memory in this particular zone, and it also knows the address of that object. So what does it do then? Well, with this information disclosure, it would be a lot more easy or useful if you have a predictable kernel heap. So you can like allocate a lot of stuff and get all these random pointers. I mean, it doesn't really help you, but if you can... So the idea here is to try to fill the heap in order to make it more predictable. Because once you fill the heap, the allocator will request new pages, and it will divide these pages into equally sized chunks. And these chunks will be served sequentially back whenever you request new allocations. So you get a sequential allocation eventually. And this is what you want to try to achieve, because if you can get this map token address and the next address is the rightly next to it, you can put user data right next to it, potentially. And that's what evasion tries to do. So evasion requests memory map objects until the kernel heap is defragmented. And it calls this function, you know, repeatedly until it sees that the map tokens are next to each other, because then it's getting new pages from memory. So subsequent allocations, it then assumes that any additional allocation is put right next to this memory object. So this is the layout of this idea here. Evasion talks to this user client, requests IO memory map objects, and the idea is to put user data into those free objects next to the IO memory map. So I'll try to skip ahead a bit. There's something called mock messages. So you can send messages to processes, can send messages between each other, or you can send messages internally. Whenever you send a message, so the idea here is to send a message that would fill this data with user data. So this message holds something called idle line descriptors. So idle line descriptors is a way of passing arbitrary size data between two entities. So each of these idle line descriptors hold 40 bytes of user control data. And while this data is being transferred or transmitted from one entity to the other, they're wrapped in this VM map copy T structure. So if you take that structure plus the 40 bytes, you get the calloc 88 zone. So the idea here is to send a message with user data and then have that being allocated right next to the IO memory map. So now evasion can predict the location of user data in kernel memory by knowing the location of the IO memory map objects. So here we have like the sender sends a message. We have a destination port that receives the message. Evasion sends the message and also receives it. However, before receiving it, this message stays in memory, so these allocations remain. And they hold data that you control. So once it has a way of finding its user data in memory, it can only like use the relative offset from the IO memory map object to create this fake pipe object. and it provides this pointer to stallpipe, and then it can fully control the function pointer and all its arguments, sort of. So now the task is to find a useful function to call, because the heap is non-executable, meaning that you can't just put instructions in this user data and jump to it. So you need to find a specific way of finding the... you need to find a function, basically, to call. And functions are within the kernel image. The kernel image has a lot of functions like memmove, memset, memcopy, whatever. So evasion tries to find a pointer to memmove. So the kernel address space, like we noticed earlier, was not entirely randomized. We had the ARM exception vectors located at that fixed address, FFFF0000. And these this vector table defines handlers for interrupts. So you have like the system call handler, some data abort handler for when you trigger a data fault or access violation, undefined instruction handler, et cetera, et cetera. And this generates an exception. And the interesting thing here is that if you call these functions directly, you can potentially catch that exception from user mode, from evasion. And that allows you to retrieve all the CPU registers at the time of exception. And since this exception happens in kernel mode, you can learn information about from where the exception occurred. So evasion calls. So when evasion controls this pipe object, it points the function pointer to the data abort handler in this vector table. And then by catching that exception, it gets the address of the faulting instruction, which was this BLX R9. So you get the real address for this instruction. So once you have this real address, and you can find out the address to the driver itself, and the driver itself has a fixed offset to the kernel, so you can learn the address of the kernel itself. And then you can reference kernel functions. But it's not that easy, but I can see we're running a bit out of time now. I'm going to go quickly through this, but it's the arbitrary read and write. So the ultimate goal of any kernel exploit is it's patching memory and reading memory. It tries to do things at runtime. It tries not to assume that certain structures are always located at certain places. So even though we have the address of the kernel now, it doesn't assume that a function is at a certain offset within that image. So it needs to locate functions in memory, and it needs to patch variables in memory. So it uses actually this exception technique that I just talked about to leak 4 bytes of memory, because all the references that occur before the exception is triggered allows you to read a pointer value and put that into R1, which is one of the registers. So you can trigger this vulnerability and leak 4 bytes of any memory you want. This is a non-ideal method because it requires the kernel it requires evasion to update the layout of the pipe object every time it wants to leak different memory. So it's a lot of things can go wrong since the memory is used not only by evasion but all the other apps in the system. So instead it tries to find a pointer to memmove, and it does this by using this leak technique and scanning from the kernel base until it finds, and then following each branching instruction. So it has like a instruction, simple ARM interpreter sort of, for translating ARM instructions, and follows branching instructions until it finds a specific signature, which is this. So it looks for this signature right here, and it's memmove, and when it finds it, it knows that this is where memmove is. I can call this to move, to read any memory I want, any size, et cetera, et cetera. So it uses memmove to read memory back into the old descriptor data buffer. It's always pointed to by the first argument. So in the end, you get something like this, memmove, and you move in source, any source you want, any length you want, into object Z, which is your data buffer that you referenced initially. And this is where it gets a bit confusing. I took a while for me to understand what was going on here. But the idea here is that the source and length is attacker controlled, so you can read any data. It's limited 24 bytes, but you can, you know, read multiple times if you want. So this is, you get the data, it gets written back into the OL descriptor, and then it's copied out when you receive the message in user mode. So it's fairly complex, fairly complicated, but it's very, very interesting how they managed to be able to do this, despite all the randomization, despite all the address separation, just by injecting data, learning information about the address space, and stuff like that. I'll skip the next approach because it's a bit. You can read the slides later if you want. But the other thing is the arbitrary kernel memory write. So one thing is to read memory, but you also want to write to memory. So for doing this, it searches for an instruction sequence called str R1, pointing to R2 BXLR. And this means you have the value in register R1 and store that where R2 points. So you can write 4 bytes to any memory if you find this. And this is used for subsequent kernel patches. So when you've done all this, what does evasion do? Well, it patches a lot of stuff in the kernel. It patches the mandatory code signing. So it takes out the code signing checks. You can now run any code you want, even if it's not signed by Apple. It disables sandbox checks. So it allows you to do certain things a sandbox wouldn't. It enables task for PID 0, which allows you to get full control of the kernel task. So it does this to avoid having to use all these convoluted techniques like setting the memory in the right layout in order to call this function, blah, blah, blah. Once it can do this, it could just operate on this task directly, and it doesn't have to do anything. It can just call APIs and use the kernel task instead. It enables RVX protection, so that's something useful, I guess. Read, write, execute. And it disables the service plist signing. So it allows you to run any service. This specifically will allow you to install OpenSSH and have that install or run every time you boot the phone, because normally that would be restricted by this mitigation right here, but since they disabled it, it's no longer restricting you from doing that. Also, code pages are initially read executable, and they are made writable by patching the physical memory directly, physical memory map. So that's how they go around that. Okay, so that was easy. So I guess it was Wednesday. Apple addressed, they patched this vulnerability in iOS 6.1.3. They said something about making additional checks, but as far as I can see, they just disabled the APIs that were vulnerable. I guess they didn't need them. I'm not sure, but it looks like they've disabled them instead of adding more checks. I might be wrong, but that's what it seemed like. They also addressed the ARM exception vector information leak, so you can't just call that data abort handler now to get register information by catching the exception. They actually check the caller of that handler. So if you call it from some arbitrary location, it won't work because it's supposed to be called from this one function. One thing I noticed is that it's still possible to leak addresses of IO memory map objects. So even though Apple patched all these vulnerabilities, you can still learn information about the kernel. So potentially, in the next jailbreak, unless Apple fixes this, you'll be able to learn information based on this vector, or with this vector. So some closing notes. So kernel address space layout randomization and address space separation, you know, greatly complicate kernel exploitation. iOS 5 was really easy. What's interesting here is that address space information leaks are critical to the attacker in order to make reliable exploits. And data injection may also be necessary because of the separated address spaces. So there's a lot more hurdles now that needs to be overcome, and this raises the costs of you know, creating these exploits, and it definitely makes it a lot harder. And it probably will make exploiting certain vulnerabilities close to impossible, you know, depending on the situation. Another thing is that sandboxing, once again, shows that it reduces attack surface. So some people think about sandboxing like, oh, you're not supposed to access this file, you're not supposed to write to this location, but it actually also restricts you from accessing services, accessing parts of the kernel, exercising certain functionality. So if there's a vulnerable function somewhere in the kernel that the sandbox prevents you from reaching, then that's good. And in this case, the vulnerability cannot be triggered by restrictive sandbox because you cannot connect to this IO-USB device interface unless you have that entitlement. So you cannot use Mobile Safari. So that's pretty good, I guess. So that was the talk. So if you have any questions, I'm free for questions. There's also a blog post on this. So this slide deck is actually based on an analysis I did for the company on the kernel exploit, and it was made as a blog post.
Okay, let's thank the speaker. It takes a while to explain complicated things.
Yeah, I hope I didn't scare people. This is
interesting. We might try to slip in a couple of questions, and then you're also available afterwards additional questions. So is there anybody who has some questions?
There's no stupid questions.
In the previous jailbreaks on iOS 5 and those devices, they also had like problems between iPad and iPhone with the processors, mm-hmm. between A4 and IA5, so they had to make like different jailbreaks for those.
Yeah.
Why is it with Evasion like they released it for all devices at once? Did they figure a simpler way out, or?
Yeah, this approach they used in this case was more generic. It's all about the vulnerabilities that you leverage. In some cases, if the vulnerabilities are present on all the devices and you know, the environment, the attack surface is similar. In the case of A4 versus A5, A4 had a boot ROM vulnerability. So it was very generic. Once you have a boot ROM vulnerability, you can basically own the kernel before it boots. It's an entirely different attack vector. In this case, they had to start by injecting via, I think it was mobile backup or some other service, and then go from there. But it really depends on what sort of services a device has available. So for instance, Apple TV doesn't have a lot of the services that are present on iPads and iPhones. So that's the reason why I don't think there's any Apple TV 3 jailbreak now. That's because of that, because they don't have the proper services that is used in this jailbreak.
A last question from anybody? Okay. Thank you, Tarjei. A little reminder from my side, the next NIST lecture is on the 26th of April. Then we will have Business Development Manager from Microsoft, Anders Føyen, coming up and talk about their view on the threat picture in commercial technology and cloud services. and how this is addressed by the Microsoft Cybersecurity Center. So based on that, I invite you for coffee and Eastern sweets outside. I wish you a happy Easter and hope to see you back after the holidays. Thank you.